This is the Richard Brown F1 engine interview for April 12th, 2007.
You started, were you working in an Army program, ABMA, before you went over to Marshall?
Worked on the Explorer 1, the first satellite.
Yes.
Then when I got out of the Army, I worked for Thiokol, who is now ATK, but I worked for Thiokol, and on solid rockets, solid propulsion, for 4 years.
They've always been solid, haven't they?
Yeah. And then I came back to what became NASA out of the Army, the transition from ABMA, the Army Ballistic Missile Agency was made. I came then back just after NASA took over ABMA, just after NASA was chartered, Marshall Space Flight Center was chartered.
In 1960.
Yeah, right. And I came in just a little after that. I came in December. I think they were chartered in October.
So you were already in Huntsville when this the transfer?
Yeah, I came to Huntsville the 30th day of April, 1955.
Okay.
Married in 80 months Vivian, and been here ever since.
Okay.
When I first went, they hired me to go into the solid rocket section during the days when they were trying to formulate the options for the lunar program, and I did some sizing work on solids for some of the options, large solids.
I know they're thinking of solids for NOVA.
Yeah.
And really wish that.
And then pretty soon, then I transferred into liquid power plant, or into propulsion performance evaluation, which was in the liquid side of the business.
Okay, which laboratory was that?
Structure and mechanics, it was called in the
days.
And propulsion was a part of structure and mechanics. Hans Paul was the division director.
Okay, somebody mentioned his name.
Yeah, and Alex McCool was the deputy.
Okay.
So then I went into propulsion evaluation from the solids, and that's where you did all the performance analysis and calculations and that kind of stuff, and then went from that to liquid power plant engineering, which was my first exposure to the F1 engine. Then in June of 1964, I transferred from the laboratory to the program of project office.
Okay.
Where I went to work for Sonny.
Okay. All right. So you're what did Sonny have you? You reported to him directly, and he in turn reported to, I guess,
Leland.
Yes.
Who reported to Dr. Bumbrun?
Yes.
Well, at one point, then they put in industrial operations as a head over all
the
contracts.
I think they had an Air Force guy in charge of Army operations.
And General O'Connor.
Yes, that's right. I remember that.
He was that. So that's the. So I worked for Sonny, who worked for Leland Bullitt.
Okay. What were your duties then, working once you came on the F1 program?
After going to the project program office?
Yes, at that point.
After the program office, I was the official title was chief of the development branch of the F1 engine. That, in Sonny's mind, I was his chief technical person for the engine.
Basically, the chief engineer. Right?
Basically, what I was doing was managing the development program.
Okay.
So I managed the development program for Sonny.
What
and
I'm trying
Frank.
To. Okay. What I want to make clear in the book is Marshall's involvement in the development of the F1. Some people have the perception Rocketdyne engineered everything. Yes, but I want to make clear the involvement of Marshall in the development of the engine. He said it was not very developed when Marshall acquired the engine program to start the F1. So I'm trying to make clear how Marshall interfaced with Rocketdyne for the development of the engine.
Von Braun always had the idea, Dr. Von Braun, procure something effectively that's of a high technology nature, you needed to be an informed, smart buyer. So the engine group in Marshall, while not, let's talk about the technical part to start with, the technical guys, the engineers who were assigned to the F1 engine, Carlisle, Smith, Ron Bledsoe, and others, they were responsible to oversee technically what Rocketdyne was doing. They had what Von Braun called an automatic responsibility to bring to light things they were concerned about from a technical standpoint.
Okay.
So it was a government, it was more than oversight, it was insight.
Mm-hmm.
They had to be able to, we had to be, and I saw this in liquid power plant engineering, we had to be able to do the engineering calculations to check. It was a matter of a hard deadline, and it's, the philosophy would be a lot like a peer review.
Mm-hmm.
You had somebody doing the work, but in order to minimize the errors and to see the integrity of it, you had the government who were basically peer reviewing what was going on and had competence. Maybe not to actually design and develop the engine, but they had competence to do the technical calculations or do the engineering calculations. And so the role was one of oversight, insight, and there's a lot of documentation that the contractor has to produce, specifications and so on, and the government has the role to review those and see that they meet what is required to fulfill the mission and to sign off on all. So the role was one of developing the programmatic framework and the programmatic machinery to keep Rocketdyne working, and then to review and approve what they did.
Okay.
We had a technical team who were perfectly competent as colleagues in the field to review. But not one for one, because there was no point in duplicating the team, not one for one, but in primary areas. You'd have a turbo pump specialist, you'd have a fellow who could do combustion calculations, you would have, and it was sufficient to be able to, when it came time to certify ready to fly, the government team had to certify it. So we had to believe in it just as much as the people who produced it.
Yes.
I don't know whether that, you understand what
yes,
I mean?
Yes, I do.
It was, you know, when you got ready to fly, it was the government team who signed up.
They had total confidence in the engine.
And of course, before they signed, they wouldn't know the contractor who built it believed in it. But the basic design team was, it was oversight of the design team, oversight of the development process. And through the contract negotiation process, you established a mutual understanding between the two organizations as to what it was going to take to do the job. Contract negotiations were a very important part. That's where you negotiated the number of engines, the number of engine tests, where you adopted a specification. It had been negotiated between the technical people here and the technical people Marshall and technical people Rocketdyne and so on. So we had to understand. I remember one of the first things we undertook when I came into the F1 office was what we call in those days a model specification, the basic system spec for the engine. And when I moved into the office, it was apparent that the one we had gone out of date, and that described the end product. So between myself and Ron Bledsoe and Carlisle Smith, I mean, we updated it to what was needed at that point in time in 1964, as best we understood it. And then that was presented to the contractor and negotiated as to what could and couldn't happen.
Okay.
Contractor had the basic responsibility for the design, the engineering, and the development. And they were the ones that did the job.
Okay.
We had to be sure they did the right job and did it right, if that makes any sense.
I mentioned had a number of people who were working to make sure that either the components or the engines delivered to Marshall were in spec before they were even tested.
There was a resident office at Rocketdyne, a government resident office, which included some quality people who looked over the manufacturing
from Marshall.
From Marshall.
Mm-hmm.
The resident office, we called it. It had a manager and some two or three engineers in it, and several quality people who looked over the quality processes to be sure what was being made was according to the product, the specifications, and the procedures.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine Rocketdyne had their resident office here, yes? Or an individual or individuals?
They had some folks here. When they got the engine up and running and produced some, then one was delivered here to Huntsville. We had a single engine stand built at the test area.
Yes.
And the engine was brought in here and tested. Now, as an advisor to the test and to run the spare parts inventory, some of the logistics to that engine, Rocketdyne did have a unit of people here.
Okay.
Who provided the logistical support. And some, maybe an engineer or two, but not much engineering, much logistical support as an engineer, because we always had the contact. The things that happened during the time of the development program was, I don't know whether this relates or not. If not, you can direct it another way, but we had quarterly reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And those quarterly reviews, everything was reviewed. You know, the handouts were pretty thick.
Okay.
And they were, you'd go out on Monday and or Sunday and review all the way through, it took the whole week. And we did that once a quarter, and that's where they stood up, and the technical people were there, the management people were there from the government, from Marshall, and everything was reviewed. And the analysis were talked about, the calculations were discussed, anything that our engineers thought was too risky or not mature enough, and those things were discussed, all in front with the decision makers present, the government decision makers, and the contractor decision makers were at the head of the table.
Okay.
And
mm-hmm.
They heard all the discussion. They eventually had to come to some conclusion to decide to press on or to do so. And the number of tests were discussed. The testing rate was discussed. You might discuss material rejection. You might discuss component quality for going well and not going well. The multiplication of components as a part of the development process while they were hung on the engine. It was an extensive, major review once a quarter. And it was always, and you've run into this with what you've done so far, I'm sure, but it was always stressed that the government team and the contractor team should function as one team. And that didn't mean we didn't have some family squabbles along the way, but it was supposed to be a team effort, and it was generally carried out with a great deal of professionalism, where we respected what they were doing and the job they had to do, and they respected the job that we had to do in an oversight room.
Okay.
So I would call it, I don't know, there's terms batted around now called oversight and insight, and I never have gotten straight exactly what they mean by that. Oversight kind of overviews it, and I may have used the word backward earlier, and insight means you're into it.
I think one of the buzz phrases today is configuration management, or is that not relevant?
Well, that's a specific phrase that has to do with how you control changes.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, that has to do with changes.
But that had to be a...
Formal changes in the hardware and the design.
That is a real... That could have been a real nest of issues, because there were so many critical parts in the engine. During development, changes had to take place. And yet, from what Sonny tells me, they would have to, Rocketdyne would have to come to Marshall and say, we want to change this component for this reason.
Yeah, the change control, we had to sign off on the changes. I know at one point we had a number of them backed up, and we had to get busy and work them off. The ECPs, engineering change proposals, is what they were. Generally documented, but the government did have to agree to those proposals, and if they required analysis or if they required supporting testing, then we had to agree on that. So there were a lot of changes along the way. The F1 engine kind of had its roots in the E1, I guess, and then got up and going, and they built one, and then they were going to run a flight rating test, and that's when they hit the combustion instability, and they came apart. So you had kind of you had a version that existed before that. That is the version up to the, what was that, FRT, and then they decided to call it PFRT,
I've heard of those letters before, and what do they mean?
Well, a PFRT is a preliminary flight rating test.
Okay.
FRT is a flight rating test.
Okay.
And flight rating test generally meant what the title implies is you were showing that it was flight worthy. Now, worthy is the wrong word, I guess. You were showing that it was ready for flight.
Yes.
But after that, then came the qualification. In other words, flight rating test was, I now have an engine that meets the requirements that are needed to accomplish according to the specifications or to accomplish the mission. Then you came along and had a qualification on it, and the qualification was to prove that it was fully qualified, to be redundant, that
enough.
It was fully qualified to do the job, safe.
To get there, though, it had to go through a number of repeated firing inspections, over and over, to glean that this engine is reliable, it'll run. And
I guess we have codified it a little bit better in later years. That is, we've made it a little more definitive. And when you're doing what some would call pioneering work, you do a lot of things, and it turns out, you know, just kind of if you do something by intuition and things like that. But the philosophy that was used for the development, the basic driving parameter in terms of saying it was ready for the lunar moon launch, was the number of test seconds on the engine. That's kind of an old standard. We had test seconds. If you look at the classical reliability charts, which are, if you want like 999 reliability at 95% confidence, you've seen those numbers charts.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see that we were aware of those. Now, we didn't think we could get there. Well, there's 2 points. Let me back up one. The Germans knew how important test seconds were. So they were always pushing on test seconds. We got to get the testing up, and we've got to get the engine running. Well, before you can get the test seconds up, you got to get an engine that hangs together and runs. And the combustion stability, I mean, they just went everywhere.
Yes.
I mean, so once we got that solved, then you could move on.
Okay.
To the testing. And I'll just give you one little anecdote. We had a testing rig. I don't have the curve anymore, but I'll try to reproduce. Had a testing rig about like this. took about a 50% increase. And that went on for about a year, and then we decided to incentivize. That is, we would pay extra fee if you could reach certain testing rates. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, the testing rate went up another sharp amount. So we had a curve that, in terms of the rate, went this way, and then it went this way. The incentive was, I said 50%, maybe it's 30% or something, but the slopes on the curve were here and here, and we laughed among ourselves and said, money can get more done than on ground. So once we incentivized it, they really got the testing rate up. And we were trying to get a significant number of tests, not necessarily statistical, because it takes, was it 2,300 or something like that, tests at the same item, which we never had, and the same item, it took 2,300 tests to get 3.9 reliability at 95% confidence or something. But we were aware of that chart. We were always trying to move up the chart. And that's what I call, but in those days, we didn't have instrumentation that would hang together. We didn't have
computer. Did not?
Did not.
Okay.
Instrumentation for that in that environment was very difficult. I remember when we first saw the instrumentation, I mean, you had some, but it was a very harsh environment, and saw an instrument, a piece of instrumentation, a pressure transducer or something, that had the electronics. It was the, you know, use the semiconductors and what have you, and they were all built in the base of the thing and then potted in.
Yes.
So they could take quite a bit. And we began to get better instrumentation. Point I'm making here, if I'm not careful, I'll lose it, but the point I'm making here is that we did not have the ability that the computers have today to simulate. So we had to do what was attribute testing. The philosophy was attributes. You just keep testing the attributes of the engine. That's pressure, the temperatures,
flow rates.
Flow rates and so on. You keep testing the attributes and you repeat that over and over again. This is at least, I don't know whether these are technically good terms or not, but it was attribute testing. Testing the attributes of the engine. And we had, and that was because of where we were technologically. Now today, you use a different development philosophy, and that is that you model the engine, and then you test to verify the model.
Yes.
You anchor what the analysts call, you anchor the model in testing. So instead of 2,500 tests like we have, you might have 200 tests today or 250
yes.
or something like yeah. that. So we were strictly into running it, until it ran.
Reliably. Yes.
And we negotiated this hot test, we call it this test incentive. And if you reached a certain testing rate, you got a certain extra amount of profit, and if you reached another rate, you got another amount of profit.
It's a brilliant contract form to have when you're trying to produce a product, if you will, like this.
Right. Provided you take the time to technically define what those limits are. Now, I'll give you one little anecdote. I don't know whether you like
it. I love anecdotes because it adds a...
We had a tough negotiation over what those steps were in that test, you know, how much, where the steps would be and what
uh-huh.
we would pay. We had a tough negotiation with that, back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
We had a number that was up here at a certain time, which, you know, that they had to achieve by a certain time. And they were wanting the number down here. We negotiated, and we finally arrived at the number. And the Rocketdyne project manager said, well, you realize, don't you, that the liquid oxygen for those tests were made down in a suburb of Los Angeles. And he said, you realize, don't you, that we're going to have locks trucks bumper to bumper from Los Angeles to Rocket Ridge.
This is what I heard.
And
because there wasn't a lot of manufacturing or producing plant at Edwards.
And he said, you know, we're going to have LOX trucks bumper to bumper from Los Angeles. Angeles to Rocky Ridge, don't you? And we said, well, we'll see how it works. Well, our resident guy out there that was at the test site, he called one day, and he laughed, and he said, I was up on Rocket Ridge and looked west, and he said, the locked trucks were coming, and he said, as far as you could see, there were locked trucks about 100 yards apart. And one of the drivers pulled up there, and he unloaded his whole trailer, and he said, well, how long will this last you? How many tests could you get out of it? Test engineer said, well, he says, well, it just takes four trucks like you've got for one test. but we got it just to the edge of the capacity of the locks that could be supplied. So we got the incentive just right. It really paid off.
Well, I imagine the locks was transferred from the tankers to the big storage tanks above the test stand.
Yeah.
I guess that's how. One was RP1 and one was oxygen.
Yeah. One was RP1, one was oxygen. But, yeah, he happened to be there.
Jamo.
So,
now, who's that? The rocket was the one who made that. You know that we're going to have LOX trucks for. Was that Sankini?
Sankini, yeah. Donald Sankini.
He's not with us anymore.
No. He had a law degree as well as an engineering degree.
Ah. So he got in on the contract.
And it was tough. But the project managers were the guys that led the negotiation with the project office. You had contract people, and they were in charge because the contracting officer is responsible for what he signs.
Yes.
But the contracting officer himself didn't have the technical capability and what have you to actually develop the contract statement of work.
Okay.
The which is a, you know, if you could look at some of those sometime, there's the terms and conditions that the government sets on the contract, and then there's the statement of work, and the statement of work is what the program office develops, the terms and conditions the contract people develop in conjunction with the program office. But there's a lot of standard things in the FAR regulations and the procurement regulations and so on. There's a lot of stuff that has to go in that's required by law or required by regulation. So the contract people get all that together and they rely on the program office. Doesn't mean the program office can't object, but some of it is not. Most of that is fixed and determined, but we basically, in the fragmenting a little bit going back now, we basically define the deliverables and set the quantity in the statement of work.
Okay.
And evaluated the proposal, came in, we had to do the technical evaluation as a contract because it included saying that the hours were reasonable and so on.
Okay. With this engine program, it wasn't like the LRB where Sunny issued a request for a proposal to whoever would want to bid on the program. Rocket Diamonds were really the only game in town. They were a sole source contractor, so there was that phase of it didn't happen. There was no request for a proposal, but the statement of work's important because the statement of work defines what the contractor's going to do.
Yeah, it does. The contract does. Now, there's a little nuance involved in what you just said. Sole source only means that you only put out a request for bids to one source. You still have to put out a request for proposal, and you still have to get one back.
Okay. And you were aware that that was done for the F1?
Oh, yeah.
That's important. I didn't know that. Okay.
I wrote a good bit somehow. So the government system of things, it works that way. Anything that you want, you have to put out a proposal and get a quote back or a bid back. It's just like...
Okay, yes.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So it's in that place where the government spends a lot of time and energy in defining what it is they want to buy.
Okay.
And it's, you know, so much engineering, so much so on. That's mm-hmm. where quantities get defined. That's where specs get incorporated. And you set the deliverables, including these quarterly reviews, or will be included.
Because they have to produce documentation too as to their progress and their findings and whatever.
They do that, and they have to produce the, there's what they produce to run themselves that has to be paid for, and then there's what they produce that has to be delivered to the government.
Right.
And the contract concerns itself mostly, the deliverables in the contract concern themselves with what has to be delivered to the government. But when you evaluate a proposal for the work they're going to do those deliverables, and in the negotiations you get into how many hours you're going to take to make an engine, how many hours you're going to spend on the test stand, how many hours it takes to test one, what the materials are, and how they're costed. You go into all of the, you really scrub it if you're doing the job right.
Okay, good.